So his fame spread throughout all Syria, and they brought to him all the sick, those who were afflicted with various diseases and pains, epileptics and paralytics, and he cured them. And great crowds followed him from Galilee, the Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and even from beyond the Jordan. When Jesus saw these crowds, he went up the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him. Then he began to speak and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. And blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And of course, the sermon goes on from there. If you're anything like me, when I was growing up and I heard this list of the Beatitudes of who is blessed, it became like a checklist of like how to be a good Christian. Like, I want to be all those things so that I will be blessed. And this is the stuff I've got to do that Jesus says you have to do in order to be blessed. But I'm mindful of the people that Jesus is speaking to that I think illuminates this in a different way than just that checkbox mentality of the things we have to do to be good Christians or to follow Jesus. He is talking to the lowest social rung. He is talking to people who are living basically from paycheck to paycheck, but just barely. Folks that Jesus would be speaking to are had the great joy of being taxed twice, once by the large entity of the Roman Empire, and then again by the local government, such that, you know, 90%, 95% of anything they brought in would go away immediately in taxes. And then above and beyond that, you had these a religious community and a religious culture that said, you have to do these things to be good and faithful Jewish people. So even if they wanted to go to the temple and practice their faith, they would be asked to spend yet more money on a sacrifice that would be acceptable to God, which is what the religious leaders told them. So from all sides, they are being told they are not enough. And even in the places where they are enough, what they have is taken from them. And so Jesus is speaking to people on the very edges of society, in the backwoods of Israel, far away from the capital of Jerusalem, people who have been largely forgotten. And he says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." Not because they need to be more poor in spirit, not because this is a checklist of how to be a good Christian or how to follow Jesus or in his day how to be a good Jew, but actually saying, you, right where you're at, God is blessing you. God wants to bless you right where you're at, in your poorest place, in your most brokenhearted place, in the place where you are mourning, in the place where you feel invisible. God is meeting you there, and God is blessing you there. No one was talking about this in the first century. These people would have been hearing these words of hope for the very first time. And so the first half are those things that you have the poor in spirit, those who mourn, the meek, and those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. The first half of these blessings are to people right where they're at, saying you don't need to do anything differently because God is already with you in the midst of your heartbreak, and God is already blessing you and already wants you to be blessed. And then the next four, I think, are actions that naturally come out of people who know that they are blessed. People who know that in the midst of their broken heart, God has met them, are going to act differently when they meet other people. And that's where Jesus begins to speak about being merciful, being pure in heart, being peacemakers, and being persecuted. And today, we're going to focus on the peacemaker aspect. That I think Jesus is saying, once you have known God in those darkest of places, in the place where you feel least acceptable, in the place where you are most brokenhearted, once you know that God is with you there, then you have, there's nothing else you can be but a peacemaker in the world. It just flows from there. I made a new friend this week. I feel like a kid, like that goes to school and is like, I made a new friend. But I made a new friend this week, and he is from a different faith tradition than the one that we practice here. And so it's been really fun to have like show and tell, like, what do you think about this? How do you guys do that? What do you think about this? How do you guys do that? And we've gotten to have some of the most amazing conversations. For instance, since I'm a youth pastor, I like to ask like fun get to know you questions, even in my regular life, which makes me the cool kid. But I ask him, I'm like, you know, if you could go anywhere in the world, where would you want to go? And he, because he's so deeply rooted in his tradition, says to me, you know, Morgan, as long as I'm being a presence of light wherever I am, I don't think it matters where I go. Which made me feel about this big, because I was going to be like, Italy. but just, I'm in awe of this friend's faith and their desire to be a light wherever they go, such that even my silly question got this really grounded, deep response of like, no, really, like, this is so serious to me that wherever I go, even in this hypothetical question world, I want to be a presence of light. And so we continue our walk this week, and he says to me, you know, if you're a pastor, if you could have your community practice any spiritual practice, and that was the one thing they did, what would you want that practice to be? And of course, we know in the Christian tradition, there are lots of different spiritual disciplines. There's lots of things that we do as an expression of our faith. But I said to him, and I didn't know I was preaching at the time, but I said to him, I really think if we were to practice peace, that would change everything. Like, if that was the one thing that we were known for, if that was the one focus of our lives, if whenever someone asked us a hypothetical question, we said, it doesn't matter where I go because I'll be practicing peace there, then I think it would change the world. Like, what if the church had a reputation, oh, that's where the peacemakers go. Oh, that's how the peacemakers get together to talk about making peace. Wouldn't that be a reputation? Wouldn't that be the kind of stuff that changes the world? And he seemed to appreciate that response. But it's not easy. When I think about peacemaking, or when I used to think about it, the first thing that came to mind was like, just don't rock the boat. You know, like peacemakers are just people who are like, I'm okay, you're okay, it's all gonna be okay. Particularly as we enter the holiday season with family dinners, I think of the peacemaker as the one who's like, we won't talk about that or that. I definitely won't talk about that. Like, it's the person that just kind of keeps things from rocking. When I think the kind of peacemaker that Jesus is talking about is actually the kind of peacemaker where it gets a little messy. And actually, it does rock the boat. But it rocks the boat for the sake of love, and because rocking the boat sometimes, I sounded Canadian there for a second, the boat. Rocking the boat sometimes is the very best news that we can offer the world, sometimes. And I don't think it's any mistake that Jesus says, blessed are the peacemakers, and then the very next thing he says is, blessed are you when you're persecuted. Because if he meant peacemaker, like, just don't rock the boat, I don't think the next thing he'd say is, like, when people get really mad when you do that, you'll also be blessed. But there's a flow to this sermon that says you're gonna find God in the midst of your darkest place. You're gonna find God blessing you in your broken heart. And then out of all of that blessing, you're gonna find that you have the energy and capacity to be a blessing to the world in a way that's revolutionary and counterintuitive and countercultural, such that you're rocking the boat for the sake of love, And it's going to make people so uncomfortable, and it's going to make some people who have power so mad that you're going to be persecuted for it. Which, of course, is the story of Jesus, right? We have him as our example. And then I wonder, why does Jesus connect peacemaking to being called children of God? And to know that, you have to go further into this sermon where he says, "You've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of your God in heaven." And so I'm always curious when the biblical writers use a phrase over and over. I'm like, ooh, he says children of God here. Where else are they going to say children of God? And in the very same chapter, you have peacemakers are going to be blessed and called children of God. And so are people who look at their enemies and love them. So are people who look at their enemies and love them. And he goes on to say, "Don't you know that God makes the sun shine and the rain fall on the good and the bad, on the righteous and the unrighteous?" Like, don't you know God blesses everyone? And that's your job too, that you are to love your enemies. And the ironic thing about loving our enemies is that they stop being our enemies. Like, you really can't continue to truly love someone and also continue to see them as an enemy. It truly doesn't work. Now, I get frustrated sometimes with these, philosophical conversations about peacemaking. Like, it's a great idea. There's reasons to do it in the Bible. God wants us to. But sometimes I'm just craving, what does it really look like? Like, give me some tangible instructions. What does the Bible say I should do to actually be a peacemaker? And sometimes the Bible cooperates, and sometimes it doesn't, right? But in this case, it does. Are you guys ready to get Bible nerdy with me? All right, you seem real excited. In Joshua, we have to go all the way back to Joshua. For those of you that know your Bible really well, you know that Joshua is the guy that takes over for Moses after the Israelites are freed from Egypt. They wander around in the desert for an absurdly long time. They come into the promised land. They decide the best way to take over that land is to kill a lot of people. And at this point in the story, we have Joshua camped outside of Jericho, ready to take the city. It's 300 years, really narrowed down. I literally have overlooked this story my whole life, so I'm really excited to share it with you. Joshua has a vision. They're camped out outside of Jericho. They're on the cusp of kind of this new world that they're creating for themselves through, frankly, a lot of violence. By coming into a new land where they say, we are against them, and they have to die so that we can live, is basically the posture of the Israelite people in this moment. But Joshua has a vision. He looks up, he's at the walls of, and we all know the walls of Jericho, super high, very cool. Joshua looks up and has a vision of the commander of the Lord's army, who I picture as a really beefy angel, right? And he looks up at this commander of the Lord's army and he says, "Are you with them or are you with us? Are you with them or are you with us?" And this messenger of God looks at Joshua and says, "Neither. I'm not even playing that game." And says to Joshua, "What you can do is take off your shoes because you're standing on holy ground." And isn't that a question that we find ourselves asking? If there's one question kind of inherent to our world, it's, are you with us or are you with them? Are you liberal? Are you conservative? Do you live on the west side? Do you live on the east side? Do you cheer for the 49ers or the Seahawks? We have constantly these conversations of, are you with us or are you with them? Are you on my team or are you someone that I should fear and remember that I am against, right? It's like a core question, kind of driven by a lot of fear, right? And other places in the text remind us that the opposite of love isn't hatred, but is fear. And so we ask this question out of a posture of fear instead of a posture of love, which God's messenger in this vision says, neither. The posture of love is that I'm on neither side. I'm not even playing that game. Your question has no power here because there is no either or. There is no us and them. There's just us. There's just people made in the image of God who God chooses to bless without any kind of bias, that God sends rain and sun on the good and the bad and on everyone in between. God simply sends blessings to us. I love this vision because not only does this messenger say, I'm not playing that game, I'm not going to give you an answer. I'm not going to say I'm on one team or the other, but I will tell you that where you're standing is holy ground. Where you are standing, God is present already. And the same thing goes for your enemy. The same thing goes for the them that you are against. I'm a little sad how the story ends because I don't really know if Joshua got it or if in his shoes I would have gotten it either because they end up destroying Jericho. But I wonder if this is a glimpse in the midst of a very violent story of the heart of God for all people. That the narrative never has been and isn't supposed to be us versus them, but that the posture of peace means entering into any area of conflict and saying, this is holy ground and we are all beloved. And it doesn't mean we all have to agree, and it doesn't mean that we all pretend like conflict isn't there and we just don't talk about stuff. Sometimes it has to get messier before it gets better, like I've been like fall cleaning my house, right, and like trying to get rid of stuff, and everything looks worse first when you're doing that kind of cleaning, but then it gets better. And so it's not about sitting around the holiday table and pretending like everything's okay and not addressing the points where there might be a little bit of tension, but it's actually about finding creative, new, different, third ways of having conversations that might end up being transformational. There is a kind of a legend at my seminary, my grad school, of a time when the grad school was just starting and faculty and the administrators were having a lot of conflict with some of the core students who were helping to get the school started. And it was like a policy issue, kind of a significant problem that they just could not see eye to eye about. And it got so tense that you had administrators and professors discussing whether they should leave and students on the same side saying, you know, maybe we should leave because we just can't get over this point of tension. We just can't seem to see eye to eye. They are wrong, we are right. And I heard this story from the perspective of one of the administrators who said, you know, it finally came to a point where we had to have a meeting. And the students actually called this meeting, and I showed up just with like, you know that sinking feeling you get in your stomach when you know conflict is about to happen and it's just unavoidable? And you're like, oh, this is gonna be ugly. I get kind of like nauseated. And he says, you know, my hand was on the doorknob and I just like, I couldn't shake this feeling that this was just gonna be a bloodbath. This was just gonna be so terrible. And he said, as he opened the door, he started to hear music. And as he poked his head in, he saw that it was coming from a student playing their violin. And as he opened the door even further, he said he started to see candlelight flickering off the walls and saw a table set with fine linen and china and another student off to the side finishing preparations for a meal. And the student simply said, we want to have a meal and talk. We know we don't see eye to eye, but we are going to share in this beautiful blessing of a meal together and try to see each other as human beings and try to understand where each other's coming from and find a middle way. Can you imagine? I mean, I'm assuming here, but everyone in this room who's a human probably has some kind of conflict in their life. Like, if you are a human connected to any other humans, you've probably experienced some kind of conflict, and maybe you're even experiencing it now. What would it look like as people who are peacemakers, following in the revolutionary, creative way of Jesus, to address that conflict, not by ignoring it, not by pretending it isn't there, and not by exploding it and meeting it with kind of a violent posture of us versus them. But what if there's a way to get creative in love? What if there's a middle way of getting creative in love and, in a sense, setting a table for someone who maybe seems like the other, maybe seems like the enemy, but instead you find that they're neither, and that there is no us and them, and that your creative third way is actually very, very holy ground. That God meets us in the midst of that difficult, messy, peacemaking work of meeting someone who we might not see eye to eye with. And it doesn't have to be... You know, my temptation is always to tell, like, really dramatic stories. Like, here's a story of making peace from the Middle East. Here's a story of making peace from an immigration shelter in Tijuana. Here's, like, epic moments of making peace. When really, I want us to think about what are the ways we can make peace here and now in Bend in our actual lives. Like, where are you experiencing some kind of conflict that needs to have a table set, that needs to be addressed in a messy but loving and beautiful way? So as we go this morning, may we remember that those third ways are holy ground, and that we're called to be peacemakers in the way of Jesus. We'll continue in worship as the morning offering is received.